We're currently looking at the subsequent period practice, meaning the daily life practice of the conventional bodhicitta. This practice of exchanging self with others, where, of course, the main meditative practice for doing this is the Tonglen practice, so we've looked at that. And now we're looking at what to do in daily life. And the slogan there is, well, the first slogan is, there are three objects, three poisons, and three roots of virtue. And it said there in the commentary, in the subsequent periods, train the mind by purifying the fields of your experience. When in relation to form, sounds, and so on that are either attractive, unattractive, or neutral, you experience emotions such as attachment, anger, and delusion. Train your mind in the following manner. So just before the break, there was a question about how to deal with attachment. And we can, you know, apply a similar idea to anger, jealousy, and most of the other mental afflictions. Is that, of course, to be able to apply any sort of antidote to a mental affliction, it would be good to catch it as it's arising before it takes control of our mind, because once a mental affliction has taken control of our mind, we're out of control. And then basically, if we're out of control because a mental affliction has taken control, one of the few things we could do is just cut from the object that is causing that mental affliction. So, you know, just get out of that situation if we're out of control already. So, of course, the trick is to catch it before we get out of control. While we're still in control, then we can do something with it. And to be able to do that, again, we need mindfulness. If we haven't developed any mindfulness through the shamatha practice and integrating that into daily life, you're going to find it almost impossible to begin to implement any antidotes to any mental afflictions. Because what's going to happen? The stimulus comes, and before we know it, we're already reacting. And then, of course, it's a bit too late. I mean, after the event, we can go, okay, I shouldn't have done that, and next time I won't, but it'll probably still happen the next time. And so really, if we want to change any of these habits and work with the mental afflictions, mindfulness is a key element. If we have mindfulness, then we can see the mental afflictions as they're arising. And then, of course, one thing we can do is, as we did in the you've been doing, I think, with Renato in the morning shamatha practice, is just observe. Just observe whatever's coming up in the mind, whether it's thoughts, emotions, mental afflictions, or whatever's coming up, just observe it. And if we can observe it, it stays as an object, and then it doesn't get hold of us. And so we can observe the mental affliction like attachment, aversion, jealousy, craving, as it's arising. And if we can simply observe it, we can see it arise and pass. So already that is helping us to work with the mental afflictions. And then on top of that, of course, we can do more. We can do as we did a little bit in the Vipassana section, the ultimate bodhicitta section, the illusory-like emptiness practice. If some mental affliction is arising, like attachment or aversion or something, look, investigate the appearance, the object. Where is the attractiveness or unattractiveness in that object that is causing this mental affliction? Or turn our attention to ourself. Where is the me that's getting angry or getting jealous or is starting to have craving? Where is that me? So that's another way of dealing with mental afflictions. And then, of course, as I mentioned before as well, often when we look at specific antidotes, the one that's often mentioned for attachment is impermanence. But also this can apply to most of the other mental afflictions. If we can really internalize impermanence, if we can come to realize impermanence and to start to experientially see things as changing moment by moment, then there's nothing really to grab onto, nothing to push against. So you'll find that impermanence is very effective in reducing particularly attachment and aversion. And here, we're using the compassion wing as a way of dealing with mental afflictions. So Here's another way of how to deal with attachment, aversion, anger, and so forth. So let's see what it says in the text. It says, sadly, just as I indulge in sensual desires now, countless beings in the universe are dominated by desire and thus indulge in infinite negative acts. Extract all of those attachments of other beings in one fell swoop, taking them into your heart and praying. May all these sentient beings be endowed with the virtuous root of non-attachment. In the same manner, extend this practice to all five poisons. So here, a couple of things to say. First, the virtuous root of non-attachment. So we saw, I've rubbed it out now, but we had the three objects, the three poisons, and the three roots of virtue. So the three poisons were attachment, anger, or aversion, and the other poison was, of course, ignorance or confusion or delusion. So then when we talk about the roots of virtue, the root of virtue equivalent to attachment, of course, is non-attachment. Or you could also say sometimes see loving kindness. The root of virtue opposite to anger, or sometimes instead of anger you have hatred, is non-hatred, or sometimes also you could call it compassion. And of course the root of virtue opposite to ignorance is non-ignorance, and then that can of course be wisdom. So here, sorry?
For aversion,
aversion, we talked about anger in the text here, but also sometimes it says hatred, so it can be non-anger, non-hatred. And what's equivalent to that, of course, is compassion. Compassion. So here, what is suggested is that if we notice some mental affliction arising, like craving and attachment is the example given here, we can go, I'm not the only one that has a lot of craving and attachment. There must be countless other beings having craving and attachment. So therefore, I'm going to take on all of that craving and attachment from others and dissolve it either into this rock of self-cherishing or dissolve it into this Buddha nature, the light of Buddha nature. And then we'll send them the positive opposite, the non-attachment, or send them loving kindness, the positive opposite to the mental affliction. So this is another way we can deal with these mental afflictions, because if we have craving, attachment, or jealousy or anger arising, and we catch it early enough before we're out of control, then we can do this. You know, if some anger is arising, take on the anger of everyone else. Send them compassion. And so this can be a way of using the compassion wing of practice for dealing with mental afflictions. And it says here, in the same manner, extend this practice to all five poisons. So when we talk about mental afflictions, we said earlier that, you know, when we looked at those mental factors, when we looked at the five aggregates presentation, the 51 mental factors, I said that 26 of those mental factors are mental afflictions. So that's the extensive presentation you'll get in Buddhist psychology about mental afflictions. And the word mental affliction in Sanskrit is klesha. And a klesha is anything that agitates or disturbs the mind. So that's the definition of klesha. A mental factor that agitates or disturbs the mind. Sometimes the word klesha is translated as disturbing emotions or afflictive emotions. But that can be a bit misleading because not all kleshas are emotions. So I rather prefer mental afflictions because it's a mental factor that afflicts the mind, that agitates the mind. Whenever you have an extensive presentation of this, we have the six root mental afflictions. And the 20 secondary mental afflictions. So these 20 secondary mental afflictions are the ones, they come out of the six root mental afflictions. So if we list the six root mental afflictions, they are listed as the three poisons, of course, ignorance, attachment, and here usually anger. And then we add to that list pride, doubt, and afflicted view. Pride is a sort of puffed up state of mind. It sort of exaggerates our good qualities. So pride, I think the definition here I had is... yeah, a mental factor that has an aspect of being puffed up. So it's this sort of puffed up state of mind. So here pride is not... sometimes we use the pride in terms of feeling good about ourselves, self-confidence. That's not this. This is called afflicted pride. It's like a puffed up state of mind. It's more like arrogance, thinking we're better than others. And doubt here is afflicted doubt. It is something that really blocks us in the path because we just doubt everything. Oh no, it can't be like that. It can't be like that. And it sort of blocks us. And then afflicted view. Here, usually there are a number of afflicted views, wrong views. And there are five of those. So sometimes when these are expanded out, then instead of the six, we'll have the 10 mental afflictions, the 10 main. These five plus these five afflicted views. But here, in the text, it talks about the five poisons. So these are the three poisons. The five poisons are the first four, and then usually added to that, the fifth one is jealousy. Is the five poisons.
Jealousy may be considered like a greed. Kind of greed.
Yeah? Mm.
So, I want this person only being mine. Yes. Don't share.
I think, actually, I think that there's two words in English and...
envy and jealousy.
Envy and jealousy, and they're not the same meaning. And I think what we call as jealousy is actually envy. Because I think jealousy is the word, how it's really defined in English, I think is a little bit different. But how what we call jealousy, you know, we're jealous of other people, is actually envy. Here, one definition of jealousy I found in a text is, in Buddhist text, upon observing others' bodies, wealth, excellent qualities and so forth, being unable to bear it. Not able to see the good qualities in others. Whereas envy is more about, oh, I want that. You know, I'm envious of that. I should have that. And that's what we often term as jealousy. So these are the five poisons here. So we can have these various presentations, either the extensive six root, 20 secondary, the six root mental afflictions, the five poisons, or here the three poisons.
And was this the 10 combo?
The 10 was this afflicted view, there's five of them. So when we expand that one out to five, we have these five plus the five afflicted views is 10.
So it's called the 10 mental afflictions?
Yeah, sometimes called the 10 root afflictions.
What is doubt?
Doubt, it's I think the definition is something like a mind that wavers between two points. But here in particular, it's sort of the negative doubt, like, no, that can't be right. That can't be right. It's sort of like this doubt away from the truth. So it sort of blocks us. Of course, we don't blindly accept anything. We need to evaluate things. So we need to be skeptical of things in a healthy way, but then investigate. But this is about, even through investigation, we're sort of coming up, no, that can't be right. That can't be right. No.
So more on the negative side.
Yeah, this one. I mean, this can have the three. They talk about three. One that is more away from the fact, an equal doubt, and one that's toward the fact. Toward the fact can be useful because it can lead us more to. But this is more the one away.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
I want to go back to overcoming attachments.
Mm-hmm.
The main attachment, food. Actually, if we look at children, they need to eat, because you will come with the story about all those people and the...
I heard one thing, I haven't tested it, but maybe you can test it. There's one person said that you don't need to worry about diets or anything. The person said he'd guarantee it, that whatever you eat, if you chewed it 30 times before you swallowed it, you could eat whatever you want. No problem.
Yeah. It sounds logical because eventually, you can't eat cardboard, but food, yeah.
Yeah, so he was suggesting that the solution, an easy solution, is to chew everything you eat 30 times before swallowing it, then don't worry, you don't have to worry about any sort of diets or anything because you're not going to.
but still, how can we reduce attachment to food? Because it's very essential, and I know that there are people that are living without food 20 years, but it's essential, and we are attached to it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course, there are a number of things we can do. I mean, in general, with craving and attachment to any of the sense pleasures is what we looked at earlier in the preliminaries, in fact, to realize dukkha. If we can realize dukkha, we'll realize, not just intellectually, but experientially, we'll realize that none of these sense pleasures are going to fulfill us. So then craving and attachment for any sort of sense pleasures, whether it's food, sex, anything, is going to dramatically drop down, because we'll experientially see this is not going to bring us satisfaction. It's not going to bring us fulfillment. So that's one thing, of course. And then, of course, we can just use the mindfulness again, as we saw here, is just notice that craving and attachment. Don't, particularly with food, don't eat on impulse. You know, if you have craving and attachment, just watch that. And wait a little bit before you eat. And that is a big help. Because it's the impulse eating that, you know, I've got to eat it. And if we can delay that a little bit, that is a big method to help break attachment to food. And, of course, to understand that we're using food as fuel for the body as well, of course, you know. But I think that's going to be very helpful, is that sort of... this delay mechanism of not acting immediately is just to watch that craving, and often it'll pass. But if you always have this thing where you say, okay, I'm going to wait certain number of minutes and then I'll allow myself to eat, you'll find often that the craving will just go.
Okay. Then you can get used to it and wait the 10 minutes and then...
But you'll find that even doing that, you'll find that your craving for food will really drop a lot.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. It's like being vegetarian in a way, or even vegan for some people, because, you know, there are people that really, I don't know, like meat or chicken or whatever. And then when they became vegetarian, it's because they were thinking about the suffering or the animals that they wanted. So from now, I have friends that, you know, even if they really liked meat before, they can't even look at it now.
Yeah, but that's an ethical thing. But I guess you can even have vegans who are craving food as well.
Yeah, but I mean,
yeah,
sure. You know, I'm vegan and I ask the question.
Yeah.
No, but
yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean,
sure.
Like with everything, I guess.
Sure,
in a way.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
craving food is not the same as being hungry.
No. I mean, of course, that's just to replenish the body, and that's fine. You know.
And do the Buddhists have a certain term for those basic needs which we just need to fulfill, like hunger, sleep?
No. I mean, because they're things that we need to do. We need to eat. We need to sleep. So that's fine from a Buddhist perspective. It's the on top of that, what we do is the problem, the craving and aversion, and that's what we're addressing. Okay.
But it's interesting, I noticed, for instance, I've been to Goenka courses a few times in India, and always the food was very tasteless. Just... and, very bad food. But here, the same like in Kopan Monastery, the food is very nice. So by these, people who come to introduction to Buddhism courses, they get attached to food, the mind and Buddhism is something related to very good food. it's very nice peanut butter and real butter, because in India they don't use real butter. Here it's nice.
And then, actually, this is an advantage, because then we've got something to work with in our meditations, that craving for the peanut butter for breakfast. We've got something to work with, so very good. But here also what we see is a little bit difference in terms of often in the Theravada traditions, when they talk about working with the mental afflictions, they're talking about sort of cutting the stimulus, you know. Often they talk about, you know, when you're walking, keep your eyes down, don't sort of look around. And then also, you know, cut from, don't eat more than one meal a day and so forth, which is an approach to do. Whereas in the Mahayana, what you find often with the mental afflictions is that you can transform them. There's methods for transforming. And then, of course, in Vajrayana, they go to a whole other level, where you don't need to. So at the foundation level, you apply an antidote, you eliminate. In the middle level of practice, you transform into the positive opposite, a little bit like we're doing here. And then at the tantra level, if you're able, you don't need to do anything. It just self-liberates. But this is not so easy. This is very difficult. So it depends on what level, how you approach mental afflictions. So that's, I think, reflected a little bit in the approach generally in the Theravada, because Goenka is part of Theravada tradition, in the approach they use for sensory stimulus. There it's a lot about avoiding unnecessary sensory stimulus. In Mahayana it's more about dealing with that and transforming, and in Vajrayana it just liberates itself. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. Okay, let's move on. So now there's another slogan here of what can help us in daily life in terms of exchanging self with others. And that is at the top on the right-hand corner of right-hand side of page 6. It says, in all actions, train by means of the words. And it says here, this line pertains to training the mind even by means of mere words. You can undertake this, for instance, by reciting the following lines from a treatise. May the suffering of all beings ripen upon me. Through my virtues, may they all achieve happiness. Alternatively, you can recite the following when no one is around. May the sufferings of all sentient beings and those sufferings causes ripen upon me, and may my own self be subdued and annihilated. So when it says my own self be subdued and annihilated, of course, they're talking about self-cherishing, self-grasping. May my virtues ripen upon all sentient beings, and may they be endowed with happiness. From the depths of your bones, cultivate the thought. Maybe instead of depth of your heart, in the Tibetan tradition they say depth of your bones. Oh, my dear mother, my dear brother and sister sentient beings, most dear indeed are all beings. This training by means of words in your four daily activities. So four daily activities. We often talk about four types of activities of walking, standing, lying, and sitting. Walking, standing, lying, sitting. Because often we also talk about being able to meditate in the four postures of sitting, standing, lying, and walking. So this is what the four daily activities here means. Involves following the sutra's admonition to cultivate loving kindness by means of mere words. So what this slogan is saying is that, you know, when we want to exchange self with others, then of course it's good at the beginning of the day to say, okay, today I'm going to, whenever I have a selfish motivation, I'm going to change that into a motivation of cherishing others. I'm going to cherish others as much as I can throughout the day. We can say that, and maybe it'll help, but we need to keep reminding ourselves of that throughout the day. So that's what's being said here, is that from time to time, it's good to remind ourselves. We have, if there's a particular short saying that we really find very inspirational and very effective, we can keep reminding ourselves, or even we can sort of post it on the wall in front of where we work or somewhere where we see it often, to remind ourselves. So we can use this as an aid to remind ourselves of what we're to do. So this is going to be very helpful to continue to be able to do this, to remind ourselves by using some small slogan. And of course, by reminding ourselves, by attending to this, then that becomes our reality. Okay, so that then completes the training in the conventional bodhicitta. So to do the Tonglen practice in meditation and then do this exchanging self with others throughout the day. So to conclude this, I'd like to read two things. First, a little bit from this book here again, on page 75. And this is actually talking about this particular slogan, in all actions trained by means of the words. So he says the following here. It's not a matter of simply parroting these slogans once we've developed familiarity with them. We have to use them to bring about a real change in our outlook. Words and phrases can have a positive or negative impact on us, depending on their content. If we really think about these slogans and understand their profound subtleties, they will help to maintain our bodhicitta attitude and interrupt our negative flow of thoughts. According to Lojong teachings, we cannot underestimate the power of these sayings. Every time we remember a slogan, it will automatically help us not to react to things in our usual, habitual way. And then another thing here. Buddhists believe that everything we think, feel, and do will result in karmic imprints. The kinds of imprints we leave in our minds through meditation are extremely important because they redirect the mind in a positive way. That's why we need to think about these slogans and burn their messages deeply into our minds. If we can do that properly, the Lojong slogans will pop up automatically in post-meditation situations and will change our mood. This mental self-talk or internal dialogue is very important. It is a form of mental conditioning because we become what we think and we think what we become. We talk to ourselves all the time anyway, but often it's just a form of negative feedback. These Lojong exercises will help us to correct that defeatist habit. Transformation doesn't come from changing our mannerisms or our way of talking. It comes from learning to think about things differently. So I think that's quite helpful, useful advice. And then I'd like to just finish this whole section by reading a little bit from the other book, from modern day commentary from Alan Wallace, called Buddhism with an Attitude. Let's see if I can find the right place. This is on page 187. There are two criteria on which to judge the efficacy of this path. One criterion relates to the powerful, deeply embedded tendency to grasp onto a reified sense of I. In Buddhist teachings, the reification of I is the fundamental delusion and the root of suffering. Practice is effective if reification of self is decreasing. In other words, if grasping onto self is decreasing. If words of abuse don't find their target so easily, if the sense of I am is getting lighter. The second main indicator of success in Buddhist practices relates to self-centeredness, the sense that your own personal well-being is your number one priority. This is the attitude that proclaims me and mine first. If you don't find that your practice diminishes self-centeredness, you need to find another practice. The cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta is designed to counteract self-grasping through the realization of emptiness, the lack of inherent existence of phenomena, including yourself. The practice of relative bodhicitta is designed to counteract self-centeredness. That is enlightenment in a nutshell. For every Buddhist practice, including Dzogchen, Mahamudra, and Vajrayana, is aimed at just those two things, ultimate and relative bodhicitta. The effectiveness of practice is measured by the decrease of self-grasping and self-centeredness. The first two points of the seven-point mind training cover the heart of Buddhist theory and practice. Why would you need anything more? So that completes the first two points. The second point here, of course, is the main practice, the two practices of wisdom and compassion. So again here, the wisdom practice is the ultimate bodhicitta practice, the Vipassana practice of emptiness, coming to realize no independent me, no independent world. And of course, that's overcoming self-grasping, grasping onto independent me, independent world. And then the compassion wing of the practice, of course, is relative bodhicitta. And that is practiced here in mind training through this practice of exchanging self with others, where the main meditative technique is this Tonglen meditation exercise. Now, another great advantage with the Lojong system of practice is this third of the seven points here, taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment. So generally, of course, when we practice any spiritual path, it's often said we need to gather conducive conditions to practice. And unfortunately, in our modern society, we have a lot of adverse conditions to practice. So it's quite difficult to find good conditions. But here in the Lojong, we have some instructions here, some slogans to help us to be able to take even difficult situations in our life, which we normally see as problems or obstacles, to be able to take these difficult situations and use them as fuel in the spiritual path. So therefore, we can take all conditions, no matter whether they're adverse or conducive, as conducive conditions. And so that's what we're going to look at here. So again, to introduce this third point, again, I'd just like to read again from this book from Alan Wallace, Buddhism with an Attitude. And he says the following. The remaining 5 points are practices for day-to-day living. These 5 points are designed to cultivate a way of engaging with day-to-day events that supports and nurtures progress gained through formal meditation. Instead of having spiritual practice deteriorate in the wear and tear of daily life or being maintained as a compartmentalized separate entity, the aim of the next 5 points is to fully integrate spiritual practice within active life so that they are mutually supportive. The remaining 5 points of the mind training address the endemic problem of spiritually unraveling in the face of adversity. Shantideva, in A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, points out that the mental impulse that is the great blowtorch for incinerating merit, that is anger. When anger grips the mind, it dissipates merit, the mind's repository of spiritual power. The Buddhist tradition says that virtue arises easily in the mind empowered with merit. If we want to mature spiritually, actually make some progress, and not be like rodents lapping the wheel of samsara, then we need to learn how to deal with anger. As the saying goes, even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. Dealing with anger means learning how to deal effectively with the adversities of everyday life. So let's have a look at what advice is given here in terms of how to take these adverse conditions into the path. So let's look at the first slogan here on page 6 on the right-hand side. Third, taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment is presented with the following lines. When the world and its inhabitants boil with negativity, transform adverse conditions into the path of enlightenment. And then the commentary says the following. Whatever harms befall you, whether caused by living beings or caused by natural elements, they are fruits of your own past negative actions. Harms are seen as adversities and obstacles by those unfamiliar with Dharma. So again, generally, we see difficult situations as problems or obstacles. And then, of course, as soon as we see a difficult situation as a problem or obstacle, we immediately have aversion to it. Oh, I don't want that. Go away. And that aversion, all that that does is it magnifies the amount of discomfort we feel. And, of course, it exaggerates and distorts that difficult situation, and then often we not only get overwhelmed by it, but we often overreact or react in a way that's not appropriate to resolve that difficult situation, and then often it actually gets worse rather than resolving it. So if we can see difficult situations not as problems or obstacles but as opportunities, and that's what we're doing here, then we can learn from those difficult situations and we can use them as fuel in our practice. Actually, if we look at our own lives, the times where we most developed as a person was not usually when things were going well. Usually when things are going well in our life, we just sort of drift along, float along, and we don't really develop as a person. It's only when we're faced with a challenge, a difficult situation, that forces us to reevaluate and challenges us, then we usually develop as a person. But usually only after a lot of hardship. Because when we're faced with that difficult situation, usually we just react with aversion, we magnify, we overreact, and then it really becomes very difficult, a big hardship. And then eventually we manage somehow to get over it and we learn from it, but we make it much more hardship than necessary. So we can learn and benefit without magnifying the discomfort and the hardship. And so that's what we're talking about here. But for someone who has entered the gateway of Dharma, the master said, so the master again is Geshe Chikawa, they are exactly like what Chengawa explained to Showa Gumpo. If someone possesses mind training, all of this, physical illness and mental suffering, is skillful means through which the teachers and the three jewels bestow their blessings and higher attainments. Therefore, you should transform all circumstances into factors conducive for training in the awakening mind. So here now, in this section, it's divided into two parts. So the first part here is training in the two awakening minds, the extraordinary thoughts. So first, we're going to look at how to take adverse conditions into the path through the two bodhicittas, through the conventional bodhicitta and the ultimate bodhicitta. So through the wisdom and compassion aspects. And then B, striving in the dual practice of accumulation and purification, the extraordinary activities. So then we're going to look at how we can then on the basis of these adverse conditions, how we can then that can motivate us to practice the accumulation, the two accumulations of merit and wisdom, and how to purify our mind of negativities. So that's the second part of the explanation. So we'll first go into training in the two awakening minds, the extraordinary thoughts. So here the first one is taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment by means of training in the conventional awakening mind. So how can we take adverse conditions into the path through conventional bodhicitta? So let's see how we can do that. Taking adverse conditions onto the path by means of the conventional awakening mind is taught first. So how does one take these adverse conditions onto the path? Reflect. Since beginningless time, I have failed to distinguish between enemies and friends. And as a result, I have failed to recognize what is to be relinquished and what is to be adopted. I have erred, because whatever spiritual practices I have pursued have all been endeavors of self-grasping. I have come no closer to establishing familiarity with liberation and the Buddha's omniscience. Today I shall therefore differentiate enemies from friends and shall ensure the success of my Dharma practice. Now my own self is the enemy and sentient beings are the friends. So other than viewing my own self as the enemy and relinquishing myself and viewing others as friends and cherishing them, nothing else is to be done. So what this is saying is that now, or what it's saying is that we've failed to correctly identify who is the friend and who is the enemy. Because now with self-grasping and self-cherishing, then of course self-cherishing is the friend, bringing me happiness. And those things and people out there, they're the things that are making me suffer. So they're the enemy. And so that's what we feel now, is the friend is this self-cherishing, bringing me happiness. The enemy is those people and things out there that definitely are the cause of my suffering. So they're the enemy, and I'm the friend. The friend is self-cherishing. So here then, what it's saying is that as long as we have this perspective, of course we're not going to be able to take adverse conditions into the path, because adverse conditions is the enemy, so we're just going to react to those. So therefore, what we need to do is to correctly understand that actually the friend, the enemy, is the self-cherishing, and the friends are others. And if we can do that, if we can understand the real enemy is self-cherishing and the friends are others, then we can take adverse conditions into the path. And we're going to have a look at how we can do that through this recognition, through recognizing that self-cherishing is the enemy and others are the friend. And so that's what it says here. Then when it says, now my own self is the enemy. So when it says my own self is the enemy, we're talking about my own self-grasping, self-cherishing is the enemy and sentient beings are the friend. So other than viewing my own self-grasping as my enemy, and when it says and relinquishing myself, it means relinquishing self-grasping and self-cherishing, and viewing others as friends and cherishing them, nothing else is to be done. So this is how we can take adverse conditions into the path through conventional bodhicitta, is by seeing self-cherishing as the enemy and others as the friend. So let's see how we can recognize self-cherishing is the enemy and others are a friend, and thereby take adverse conditions into the path. So the first slogan, the first is recognizing your own self as the enemy. As for the reason why your own self is the enemy, this is presented by the following line. So again, what we're talking about here is mainly, of course, self-cherishing, but because this is the conventional awakening mind. But of course, the basis of self-cherishing is self-grasping. So here, the real enemy within the context of conventional bodhicitta is self-cherishing. So here the slogan is banish all blames to the single source. So again, before we read the commentary on that, I'd like to read what Alan Wallace says in his Buddhism with an Attitude about this slogan, banish all blames to a single source. And this is on page 194. When adversity strikes, trace it to its root, the one culprit. When somebody irritates you, when you become angry or disappointed, find the culprit. The mind does not get disturbed because of other people's behavior. Frustration and unhappiness occur because self-centeredness makes us unable to bear other people's behavior. Self-centeredness has us in its power and can make us very unhappy. When the mind training says, blame everything on one culprit, the one culprit is self-centeredness. During the course of the day, identify moments of self-centeredness. Identifying self-centeredness in other people is easy, but benefits no one. Only identifying your own self-centeredness brings about spiritual growth for ourselves. It is my self-centeredness, not yours, that gives me grief. A teacher encourages us to recognize self-centeredness, our dearly beloved malevolent enemy that harms us day after day and will do so forever until it is counteracted. This advice, central to Dharma, runs counter to some of our favourite modern ideas about the route to happiness, such as embrace every aspect of yourself and don't judge or reject any part of yourself. Accept yourself wholly. Shantideva's advice is to check within your mind, recognize that some of the impulses that arise there are poison and need to be absolutely annihilated. Which approach should we choose? Bear in mind the metaphor of the warrior. The Buddhist tradition describes the spiritual path as war. Military analogies abound in Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Our real enemies are not human beings. They are the mental afflictions of anger, jealousy, arrogance, and delusion, with the top general in command being self-centeredness. Shantideva says, identify your number one enemy, self-centeredness, and vanquish it. From a modern psychological point of view, destroying the enemy of self-centeredness might appear to be a radical fragmentation of individuality. The notion that some mental processes, such as generosity, openness, cheerfulness, are acceptable, but others, the chief being the great demon, self-centeredness, are to be exterminated, seems to be the antithesis of the modern psychological viewpoint of self-acceptance and integration. However, the modern psychological theme of global self-acceptance and the Tibetan Buddhist warrior stance of complete annihilation of the enemy of self-centeredness may not be as different as they first appear. For example, when you get the flu, you never think, oh, this flu is part of me, I must embrace it. The flu virus is not you. It is a foreign element that has invaded your body and is doing it harm. Similarly, mental afflictions, all of them, are not innate constituents of your mind. Self-centeredness is not an innate element of your mind. Habitual, yes. Innate, no. You can accept yourself and yet recognize that there are invaders of the mind, just as there are viruses that invade the body. As you ponder this, consider, who are you really? Apart from your mental afflictions, the personal history, virtues and talents, you have acquired your body and behavior, none of which is you. What you is left over before you wholeheartedly embrace the ideal of accepting yourself as you are, it might be a good idea to discover who this you is. Shantideva writes, if all the harm, fear and suffering in the world are caused due to grasping onto self, what use is that great demon to me? The challenge here is to identify self-centeredness, but not to identify with it. Self-centeredness is an affliction, metaphorically a demon that possesses the mind. Shantideva continues, how can I delight in the cycle of existence when constant, long-lasting enemies, who are the sole cause of the perpetuation of a mass of adversities, fearlessly dwells in my heart? As long as the mind is encumbered with self-centeredness and its attendant mental afflictions of anger, attachment, jealousy, arrogance, and the rest, no matter how hard you strive to find the ideal environment, the ideal family, the ideal job, happiness will remain elusive. Shantideva concludes, note the difference between the fool who seeks his own benefit and the sage who works for the benefit of others. Without exception, spiritually enlightened beings haven't taken the path of me first, craving and latching onto their own well-being at the expense of others, but instead have sought to be of service to others. Only by cherishing others more than ourselves can we find genuine, lasting happiness. Okay. So let's have a look now what the commentary says here about this slogan. So again, the slogan is banish all blames to the single source. And of course here the single source is the self-cherishing mind. This line presents the perceiving of your own self as the enemy. Whatever calamities befall you, without blaming others, you should think this is due to my own self-grasping. So here often when they talk about this self-grasping, I think they're really also mainly talking about the self-cherishing that comes from that self-grasping.
What is the difference, self-cherishing and self-grasping?
That's exactly what I'm going to explain.
Oh, okay.
So self-grasping is grasping onto a self. And self here is, again, this sort of overinflated false sense of me. And we saw that in the Theravada, when they come to realize no self, the self that they are eliminating or refuting is this self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Whereas here in the Mahayana, when we talk about self-grasping, we're talking about grasping onto independent me, inherently existent me. So the way to overcome self-grasping, of course, is through wisdom, this wisdom of emptiness. So here, of course, this wisdom of emptiness is this ultimate bodhicitta. Self-cherishing, of course, is based on self-grasping. Because self-grasping sees ourselves as independent of the world, independent of everything else. And it's on that basis, then, that self-cherishing not only sees ourselves as independent of the world, but the center of the world. My happiness is more important than the happiness of anyone else. So self-cherishing is this selfish, self-centered attitude that sees my happiness is more important than the happiness of anyone else. And so, of course, the antidote to that is the conventional bodhicitta. Particularly here in the Lojong, is we are doing this exchanging self with others, meaning we are replacing the self-cherishing attitude with an attitude of cherishing others. So often in this section here, when he talks about self-grasping, I think what's implied, particularly because it's conventional bodhicitta explanation here, is also implied, implicit, is the self-cherishing that comes from that. In this manner, scatter all the accusations fermenting within yourself, it has been taught. So here is another quote from Shantideva, from his Bodhisattvacharyavatara. Whatever harms exist in the world, whatever dangers and suffering are in the world, all of these arise from grasping itself. What use is this great demon for me? And then on the top of the next column, there's another quote. This is a quote from a text, I think, called Pramanavartika, from great Indian master Dharmakirti. If there is self, recognition of others arises. On this division of self and others, grasping here is another word for attachment. Grasping and anger arise, and in relation to these two emotions, all calamities come into being. So here we see a little bit what we looked at the other day, this six-step process, that from ignorance arises the attachment and aversion, all the other mental afflictions, and then all the suffering experiences from that. And then there's another quote following that, and again, this is back in Shantideva's text. He says, recognizing myself as flawed and others as an ocean of higher qualities, I will thoroughly discard grasping itself and practice embracing others. And so that is sort of then, these quotes are then exemplified in the following paragraph in the commentary here. So let's read that. It says, reflect. All shortcomings and defects I may possess originate from my grasping at selfhood. Again, grasping at independent me, inherently existent me. From beginningless time, I have held on to a self when there was none. As I said the other day, it's quite crazy when you think about it, that a non-existent is the source of all of our suffering. And it's just here, believing in it and grasping at it, that we suffer. I have held on to a self when there was none. Wherever I was born, though there was no self, I have grasped at my body as the basis of my selfhood. So, of course, when it says there was no self, we're not saying there was no me. We're talking about no independent me, no inherently existent me. That's never existed, does not exist now, can never exist. Taking its side, I have resorted to rejection and affirmation depending on whether I deem something desirable or undesirable. So we saw that in that suffering and its causes chart. Is that from that self-grasping, when we see something attractive, we develop attachment, something unattractive, aversion. That's what's being said here. In this manner, I have committed all three, deception, duplicity, and deviousness towards others, and as a consequence have accumulated afflictions and negative karma over and over again. This has compelled me since beginningless time to endure the incalculable sufferings of cyclic existence in general and the immeasurable sufferings of the three lower realms in particular. So we see here then the process of how that grasping leads to the mental afflictions, that's driving our behaviour, and particularly if we engage in harmful behaviour, that leads to suffering experiences not only in this life but in future lives as well. Still, as stated in the following, so again, this is a quote from Shantideva, although countless eons have passed, with such great hardships, you have sought only suffering. So long as I fall to view this, the self as the end. To view this self as the enemy. I mean, the self grasping. So long will I continue to seek the well-being of this self. So again, so long as we engage in this self-grasping, then we're really going to be stuck in self-cherishing. Consequently, I will accumulate negative karma that will compel me in the future to wander in the infinite cycle of existence, where I will suffer even more and for longer than before. So this cherishing of self brings about all the sufferings of the three times, just past, present, future. Since this self has been my own executioner and my enemy from beginningless time, then in all the deaths I've experienced in the beginning cycle of existence, no one else has done the killing. Rather, I have been killed by my own self. As if biting your lower lip, firmly hold your own self as the enemy. Where is this enemy? It is in your own heart. Shantideva taught, for example, so again quoting Shantideva from the same text, if this ancient enemy long settled, the sole cause of steadily increasing hosts of harms, has found its home within my very heart, how can there be joy for me within this cyclic existence? Think that this kind of behavior, and here's a Tibetan saying that's a bit obscure, living on the head yet not giving victory to the eyes is most inappropriate. And this is a bit of an obscure Tibetan saying, and there's a footnote regarding that that's explained here. He says, and this is Thupten Jinpa who translated this text, one of the main translators for His Holiness Dalai Lama when he teaches in the West, and he says, this is probably an old Tibetan saying. A slightly different version of this saying reads, and so here's the other version of the saying, through living on the head, yet throwing mud into the eyes. Does that make any more sense? The saying describes the ingratitude of someone who deliberately harms those from whom he or she has received benefits. So that's what it is. It's like being ungrateful towards someone who's benefited you. I think this is sort of the meaning of this saying. Thus the focus or the sight of this self-grasping, which is the source of all defects, is the very body you are born into. Since beginningless lifetimes, you have held on to an I when there was none. You have held on to a self when there was none. Self-grasping is fraught with defects and is the source of all sufferings. So to cherish, look at, and protect this discolored human corpse, a lump of pus and blood and a sack of mucus, is like carrying a bag of thorns on your back while naked. Happiness could result if you let go. So here, of course, it means to let go of self-grasping. But instead, you believe that pursuing self-interest will bring happiness and thus sink ever deeper into suffering as though you craved it. So again, here we fail to recognize between enemy and friend. We think self-cherishing is our friend. Others are the source of our suffering. They're the enemy. And then, of course, the more that we indulge in self-cherishing, the more suffering we experience. And the more we harm others, the more we suffer. So here at Shantideva puts it very succinctly in this verse from his text again, Bodhisattva Charyavatara. Whatever suffering is in the world arises from wishing for one's own happiness, meaning due to self-cherishing. Whatever happiness there is in the world is in the world, arises from the wish for others' happiness. So again, suffering is coming from self-cherishing, happiness comes from cherishing others. What need is there to say more? The childish pursue their own interests, while the Buddhas act for the welfare of others. Observe the difference between these two. And then just a little bit more, and then we'll finish for today. Among all the afflictions that have harmed you since beginningless time, this self-grasping is the worst. This jealous, evil-ridden force that makes beings commit negative acts against all other beings, from high spiritual teachers to lice, resides right here in you. It obstructs the attainment of freedom from cyclic existence and ties you further into bondage. This force welcomes all human and non-human agents of harm. And here's another Tibetan saying: this owl-headed betrayer is the very mind that grasps onto an I or self and seeks only its own selfish ends. So here, owl-headed betrayer, apparently in Tibetan culture, an owl, in Tibetan culture, if an owl howls at night time, it's considered to be an ill omen. Something bad's going to happen if you hear an owl hooting at night time. So that's in the Tibetan culture. So therefore, this owl-headed betrayer, I mean, of course, it seems to be our friend, but it's an owl-headed betrayer because that self-grasping is the omen that something bad is actually going to happen to us, is what the analogy here is. Thinking in this manner, you should recognize the enemy as the enemy. So here again, we're starting to recognize self-grasping, but in particular, self-cherishing as the enemy. Within all the hundreds of world systems of cyclic existence, this has harmed me. Rouse your vengeance thus and destroy thoughts of self-interest. So again, this is a quote from Shantideva, of course. If you still feel unable to eradicate this self-grasping, then cultivate the following thought. This time it is different. Today I have sought a spiritual teacher, I have read the sutras, and as a result, I have now recognized the enemy. It has been stated. So again, this is another quote from Shantideva. The old days when you could ruin me at will are now gone. I can see you now, so where are you off to? I shall tear down your arrogance. So just maybe one more paragraph and then we'll finish for today. It says, contemplate along these lines, and whenever any self-centered thought arises, the master said, so again Geshe Chikawa he's quoting from, you should be cognizant and strike at the snout of this boar with a cane. So what does that mean? So again, this is a little Tibetan saying. So it means that when some self-centered thought arises, we should knock it on the head straight away. And to strike at the snout of a boar with a cane, here, coming from Tibetan culture, Alan Wallace talks about this in his book on page 220. There is an old Tibetan aphorism, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche used. So Dilgo Khyentse was a great modern-day master in the Nyingma tradition. And it's hit the pig on the nose. So that's what's being said here. Hit the boar, hit the snout at the snout of the boar with a cane. So hit the pig on the nose. And there's another one together with that here that he quotes. Clean the lamp while still warm. So they're the two sayings. And then Alan Wallace says, this wisdom stems from rural Tibet, where the animals make themselves at home on the bottom floor of the house. Sometimes the animals climb upstairs into the bedrooms and kitchen. What do you do when a pig pokes its snout through the kitchen door looking for stuff to munch? Hit him on the nose before he gets the other 200 pounds through the door. Hit the pig on the nose quick enough and he turns tail. But a pig that is already feeding at the trough is hard to get rid of. The same, so you get the idea that if you allow self-cherishing to take hold of our mind, very difficult to get rid of it. So you need to hit it on the snout, hit it on the head as soon as it arises, and not allow it to take hold. Otherwise, it's very difficult to get rid of the self-cherishing. Like the pig that's trying to get its head through the door, you knock it on the snout before it gets in the door. Otherwise, difficult.
It is animal farm.
And then the other one about the clean the lamp while still warm. It says here, the same goes for kerosene lamps. Cleaning a lamp when it is warm is easy. Wait until it is cold and you have a gritty problem. So if the lamp gets cold, it's very hard to get the grime off it. But while it's warm, it's easy to remove. So I think you... So he says, as soon as you identify afflictive tendencies of the mind, as soon as their snouts poke through the door of your mind, hit them on the nose and clean the lamp of your mind while it is still warm with afflictions. These are not abstract philosophical concepts. So just one more sentence and then we'll stop. It says, therefore, it was taught that as far as the subject matter of all the teachings of the great vehicle is concerned, the great vehicle is the Mahayana, there are only two themes. Totally let go of self-grasping, and two, upholding sentient beings with deep concern. And on this basis, crippling this self-grasping as much as you can and nurturing sentient beings as much as you can. So again, there's the two faults of self-grasping, self-cherishing, and the antidotes to those are the ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness, conventional bodhicitta here in the form of cherishing others, exchanging self with others. So I think we can stop there for today. Is there any last question before we finish for the day? Yeah.
About this saying, what is the enemy? It's in your heart.
It's in your heart. So in your heart, this heart here can be also mean mind. So in that, because often in English, we often talk about thinking and feeling. You know, often we talk about thinking in the head and feeling in the heart. But of course, both of those within Buddhism is mind. So here, when we say it is in your own heart, I don't know what the Tibetan here is, but heart also means like essence. It's within ourselves. So here it just means within our own mind. It doesn't mean in the physical heart, of course. But it just means it's within ourselves rather than it's out there.
So, but many, like also one geisha we met here, or Obina, all the time they speak about the mind, they pointing this place.
One reason can be, of course, as we saw earlier, from a Buddhist perspective, the mind is not physical. So technically it's not here, or anywhere. It doesn't have a location, technically. But within Mahayana Buddhism, particularly in Vajrayana and Tantra, when we talk about the very subtle mind, that we talked about that at every level of the mind, there's a corresponding body. Coarse mind, the body is this, brain, nervous system, body. Subtle mind has the subtle body, which is the subtle wind energies and chakras and channels. And then the very subtle mind has as a support a very subtle wind energy. And of course, energy has location. So the very subtle wind energy that is the basis, the support for the very subtle mind, is said to be within the heart chakra. So in that sense, we point here. Because the very subtle wind energy is here, but that doesn't mean the very subtle mind is here. But that's sort of the reason. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Otherwise we'll finish there.
It's like they do body, speech, and mind. Yeah.
Yeah, body, speech, mind. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So we again, it's to do with generally with also chakras. You know, we have the chakra here, a chakra in the throat, and the chakra here. And again, mind then, when we talk tantra, this is the very subtle wind energies here. So that's why the correlation with the mind here. Only in that sense, though. Okay, let's leave it there.